Lord and Heavenly Father, we thank you that you give us your word that we might know you. And I pray, Lord, that as I preach tonight that I might be reflecting your word in what I say and that all things might be to your glory. Amen. Well, today we're starting an 11-part series on Joseph. Of course, this isn't the adoptive father of Jesus that some of our jokes were about. But this is the guy from Genesis 37. He's the second youngest son of Jacob, also known as Israel. And he's the man who, along with his 12 brothers, would start the nation of Israel. Amy reminded me a little before we started that if you want to do a little bit of research for this series and you're a fan of musical theatre, you can always watch Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. I don't know how helpful it'll be, but it'll be a start. Over the next 11 weeks, we're going to see a guy who really had a rocky start. But for those of us who've read Genesis before, we know that in the end, he's actually going to succeed. And he'll become the most powerful man in Egypt after Pharaoh himself. And he's going to go on to do great things. Of course, the temptation when we have characters like this that we run into in the Bible is just to focus on the victories and forget about all of the messiness that they might have come from. All the things that they struggle with personally or all the pain that either they or other people, they've put other people through. It's the thing I often call the stained glass syndrome. To a certain degree, I think it happens when we read the Bible, particularly when we know our Bible well. You read a story about Jesus and you jump straight to the fact that we know he rose from the dead and we miss out some of the tensions of this life that he was living and the things for the disciples. We put on our Bible reading voice when we're speaking in front of others and we make it sound all serious and official and we lose out on some of the emotion. And sometimes we imagine the whole picture is kind of like a stained glass window, a perfect and colourful, and we miss the fact that there is messiness and there are things that are happening in the story. And so I thought tonight as we start our new series, I wanted to really anchor us a little bit in the reality of Joseph's story. Firstly, that Joseph, his family had a troubled past. As our story begins, Joseph himself has a troubled present, his reality we're going to see tonight. And then as we continue through this story tonight, and as we're going to see in the following weeks, Joseph's mouth also leads him to a troubled future as well. It's not a stained glass story, but a story about somebody who is really human and with whom hopefully we can really connect as we go along, to see Joseph, a future leader with much to learn, as Alan called tonight's sermon. Well, if we want to understand Joseph, the first place we have to start is really understanding his family. Now, Joseph's dad was a guy called Jacob. He was also known as Israel, the name he got later. And when Jacob was born, Jacob was born a twin. His name was Jacob because the word literally meant heel. And when he was born, his brother Esau, the big bloke, was born first. And Jacob came out holding the heel of his brother. Now, the name also means undermines or supplants. And that's a perfect word when we're talking about Jacob, because that's exactly what he did to his brother. My great hope is that my twins have a slightly better relationship than theirs. Now, Jacob's brother Esau was the classic alpha male. He was a good hunter. He went out. His dad loved him. He was the hairy one, the manly one. And Genesis seems to imply that really he and Esau and their dad Isaac were really tight. They were close. But Jacob, the little brother, was the one who was more conniving. One day Esau came in after a successful day of hunting and he was absolutely starving. He was famished. Jacob, the homebody, had been cooking. He had some lentil stew on the go. And so Esau says, "Give me some of the stew, I'm starving." And Jacob says, "No worries. You just got to promise me that I can have your birthright. You're the first son. You're getting the inheritance. I want that." And Esau foolishly says, "What good is my birthright if I die of hunger?" And so he agrees. Now, of course, it's the kind of banter that siblings might have with each other. "I won't do this unless you give me everything you have." But nobody really expects to actually pay out on this. But it appears that Jacob did. Later on, things got much worse. Isaac, their father, is at death's door. He's blind, he's sick, he's about to die. And Jacob's mum says, "Here's your opportunity to get even more." And so he masquerades as his brother. He cooks his brother's signature dinner. He puts some goat skin on his forearm so that when his dad grabs him, he feels hairy like his older brother. And he tricks his blind dad into thinking, this is the one I'm supposed to give my final blessing to, my heir. And the younger brother supplants, he steals even the blessing from his big brother. Now, Jacob later tries to make some kind of amends because he figures his big brother, the alpha male, is going to kill him. But really, he's a guy who's pretty much self-obsessed. He's not the model citizen you might hope for in, say, an upstanding church member. And surely not the kind of guy who you'd think would be the father of the tribes of Israel. And this is the kind of background that Joseph, our main character in our series, is born into. We see how the whole problem is exacerbated when we consider how messed up his own family became as well. Joseph had 12 brothers, and it wasn't just because he had a very busy mother, but because there were four mums. Jacob was interested in a woman called Rachel. This is the woman for me. This is the woman I'm going to marry. And so, as was often the case in those days, he's told by his father-in-law, you have to work for me. You've got to earn this marriage. Work for me for 7 years, and then you can marry my daughter, Rachel. So he worked for Rachel's dad, Laban, for 7 years. And before he could marry his bride, well, on the night of, they must have had a great party because the wedding night happens. He wakes up the next morning, and it's not Rachel next to him. It's Rachel's sister, Leah, who he had absolutely no interest in. Now, I don't know exactly how this happened. Maybe that he had too many drinks that night. Maybe there was a really dark room where he was to meet his wife. But he ended up with the wrong woman. How would you fix that kind of situation? A really quick divorce, maybe, or something else? We have a really bad result in this story, though. Instead, they decide, how about you work for me for another 7 years, and then you can have both of my daughters to be married to? Can you imagine what it would be like to have to compete for your spouse's love and attention if there was another partner in there? It would be a horrible thing. Imagine how much worse it would be if your very own sister was the person that was also married to your spouse. Now, to take things to a final level of indignity, Jacob has children via Leah and also Leah's servant Zilpah. Rachel's servant Bilhah also has kids through the father. And then finally, the last couple of kids come through, Joseph and Benjamin, when Rachel herself has kids. And so the outworking of this is quite simple, but mind-numbingly complicated and difficult at the same time. We have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, and they are all Leah's kids. She's the one who married to Jacob first, but Jacob never loved. So there's going to be tensions there. Then Dan and Naphtali are born through Rachel's servant Bilhah, when she was worried that she wasn't able to have kids. And so there's a little bit of extra tension. So Leah goes, well, now there are these other kids, so I'm going to get my servant to have even more kids so that I can be even more in favour. And so Gad and Asher are born into the relationship. And then finally, Rachel actually does get to have some kids. Joseph is born, and then finally Jacob has a son through the woman he actually loved. And then very last of all, Benjamin comes along. But then Rachel dies during childbirth of her second son, and so there's going to be tension there as well. What an amazingly messed up family situation. 12 boys, but Jacob has two clear favourites, and one of those is Joseph, who really seems to shine out. Verse 3 makes this really clear for us. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he'd been born to him in his old age. And he made an ornate robe for him, so nice that it's got its own musical written about it. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and they could not speak a kind word to him. You see, what we're seeing here is not a story about a holy and happy bunch of Bible folk. This isn't a story about people who had it all together with themselves and with God, and why can't we be just a little bit more like them? That's what we often expect from Bible stories. This is a story about people who are broken, about relationships that should be right but aren't quite right. A father who's been ruthless and foolish in the way he's gone about much of his life, Children who are struggling because all of their formative years have been filled with mothers that are in competition with each other and a father who's more than happy to play favourites. We can read a story like this and say, well, this is a story that is a little bit like my story. Or this is a story that's actually worse than my story. Here's somebody who I actually have it more together than these people. Things certainly get worse as we see the early picture of Joseph, and it's not a flattering one. In our second verse, Joseph is 17 years old. He's shepherding with Dan, Naphtali, Gad and Asher. And he comes across some issues that he's not happy with. So he goes home and he complains about his brothers. Now, it is a possibility that he actually had a legitimate complaint about his brothers and that he was actually telling something in a good way. Though I don't think that's the case. The word that we see translated as bad report carries a sense of gossip in other parts of the Bible. In Numbers 13, the same word is used when people came back from the Promised Land and said, here's this bad report about the place, don't attack it. Either way, he's just the baby of the family. He's already being showered with praise. But even then it appears that he sees it as his job to actually undermine his siblings. And here I think we see our first kind of application. While the passage doesn't spell it out chapter and verse, it's pretty clear that I think that Joseph was being totally ungracious when he comes back and he has this stuff to say about his sibs. It leads me to ask this question, what are my intentions when I'm speaking out against other people as well? This is, I guess you could call a maybe application, not an absolute application of the passage. When it comes to me speaking out against others in a particular context, I need to ask myself the question, is my purpose actually to help this situation? That somebody needs to be looked after or they're putting somebody else in danger? Or is it the case that when I come and make a bad report about other people, I'm actually doing it because it makes me look better? Or I want to paint myself in a good light? Truth be told, when I look back particularly to my childhood, I know that was often the case. If I ever dobbed on my siblings, it wasn't because they were doing something wrong most of the time. It was because I looked like the good kid if they looked like the bad kid. And it is one of those lessons that it's really difficult for us to get right with our kids, isn't it? We have this tattletale lesson. On one side, if one of the other kids is doing something that's dangerous, either endangering themselves or others, then we want our kids to feel like they should be confident to come and tell us. Let us know if there's a problem. But of course, we know at the same time, you empower your children to do this, and then they often take things to the nth degree, dobbing each other in for everything, and they're doing it for the wrong reasons. And Joseph, I think, appears to be doing things for all the wrong reasons as well. At very best, he doesn't actually stop to think about what it looks like as he's actually bad-mouthing all of his brothers. And we get the sterling example, I think, of why I think he doesn't have good intentions as he messes up with a couple of dreams. In the first dream, verses 6 to 7, Joseph dreams that he's out with his brothers, they're binding sheaves of grain together, and his sheaf stands up in the middle and all of the other sheaves bow down in front of it. And so he tells his brothers just that. What's his purpose in sharing this information? What's the outcome that he hopes to achieve in letting them know that he's going to be famous and they're all going to be subordinate to him? I think Australians are particularly sensitive to this kind of picture, this kind of image, because we're the ones that really don't like the tall poppy. We have this democratic idea that everybody should be kind of even, and if you are famous, you're not allowed to point it out to other people. They have to point it out to you. But Joseph has a dream where all of his siblings are bowing down to him, and he goes and he tells them all about it, and he does it with pride in his voice. Now, to be honest, I don't know what the answer is to how Joseph could have made things better. Maybe he could have just kept it to himself. At this point, we don't know actually whether or not God's behind the dreams or it's just a dream that he has. Later on, it becomes clear that this is a gift from God, but at this point, it hasn't been spelled out. Maybe the best answer would have been that Joseph has the dream. Secretly, he feels like this is really God. Good. God has something great ahead for me. But then he doesn't say anything about it because he doesn't want the others to feel bad. It's not like they need to know the information for him to achieve this end. After all, not even the most humble of people like to be told I'm going to rise up in front of you, and you and all of your brothers and sisters are going to bow down before me. Just to consolidate things, Jesus has a second dream, and this time it goes similarly.
Joseph.
Oh, sorry, Joseph, thank you. This time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to him. The 11 stars are the siblings, and the sun and the moon are his mum and his dad. And so he goes and he tells his dad about the dream as well. Do you think you're better than the sun and the moon? Do you think that the whole world is supposed to bow down before you? It's almost, the dad responds almost as if Joseph is saying that he's better than everybody. Now, Jacob, to his credit, still ponders on this, just like Mary pondered when God spoke to her. And he understands, well, maybe there might be something deeper about this, but he's not happy. Again, the only way he could have got out of this situation any better would have been if he just said nothing about it. It makes you wonder why, or at least it makes me wonder why. Why is such an insensitive, unhelpful kid the center of one of the most crucial stories in the Bible? This is a story that begins the nation of Israel. Why did things all come together and happen like this? Why would God pick an arrogant young bloke from a troubled family to be one of the Bible greats? Well, I do think there's an answer. In fact, I think there's three conclusions that we can draw from this that'll help us as we really continue our series and as we try and see the bigger picture. The first is, I think we see in this one of these really helpful golden reminders that God's family is actually our family. We could look around our congregation today, and though we might not talk about it to each other too much publicly, we know that there are tensions within some of our families. It might be that you have ungracious kids, or it might be that your kids are thinking that they have really overbearing parents. Maybe there's been breakdown in relationships and it's causing tensions. Maybe your family is like my family, and that means it's a little bit like Joseph's family. I'm a child of divorce, and so I have step-parents and half-siblings, and that meant that there, even though I know my parents did the best possible job, there was always some of that tension where I thought, my half-brother is getting a better deal than I am, and there was anxiety that went with it. The temptation when we feel these tensions and pressures and things might feel like they're falling apart a little bit in our family is to think, there's no room for God in all of this. God is a God of perfection and goodness. He can't be working in this messiness. We can think if we're going to discover God, then we have to have a deeper relationship with him outside of all this. We must have our immediate relationships. They've got to be solid ones. But in the beginnings for Joseph, we see a family that was dysfunctional on this whole extra level. A father with four wives, a dad who's setting a bad example. The wives, understandably, have a great deal of tension and anger amongst themselves, and the kids are struggling to assert their identity, particularly when the oldest means absolutely nothing because the dad loves one of the youngest. But God is still at work amongst his people. It's going to be painful. In fact, it's going to be very painful. But God is working through all of the messiness. And as Joseph and the others try to hold on to God in the midst of this, this is actually what's going to cause growth in all of them. We'll see all of our characters grow and change and come into a deeper understanding of who they are and who the God is that they follow. If God can be there for Jacob and Joseph and his family, then God can be there for you also. He can work in you, through your circumstances, and though it won't be easy, God can actually make you a better person through all of the things that you are going through. It's going to take a fair few chapters, but we'll see this is what happens for this family. Hopefully I haven't ruined the story for you by telling you there's a good ending. The second thing that I think shines through as we consider this passage is connected to this, and that is that God makes a habit, I think, of picking people like this. Now, the weak and the worried, the sad and the sorrowful, so that God's glory shines through their circumstances. I find it one of those oddly comforting things as you look at the Bible story. You look at some of these situations and you say, only God could redeem something so messed up. A horrible circumstance like this. You can look at Adam and you can see how Adam and Eve have absolutely rejected God in their actions, but God still says, through your children, there's going to be something that will crush the serpent's head. Through a guy like Abraham, who keeps on telling the local people that the woman who's his wife is actually his sister because he's too scared of saying, "This is my wife," in case they kill him. And yet God can use this weak-minded person and actually use him to build together a nation. Through King David, who had such a weakness in his character that he'd be involved in adultery and connected with that a homicide. In an odd way, what a great reminder that it's not actually about these characters we're reading about. It's not like we need to get to the end of this and say, "I want to be more like Joseph." But we can realize that even though I might be like Joseph in some ways, I can realize that I have a relationship with the same God. That the center and the heart of all of our stories is actually the God who is always consistent, who is always loving, who is always gracious, who is always forgiving, who is always willing to work in and through whatever circumstances might come up. And so we come to the final application, and this is the one that hit me like a ton of bricks this week. Joseph has a gift. He's very talented in a number of areas, but as we continue in our series, we're going to see that dreams is a big area that he seems to work at. That he has dreams, that they mean things, that he understands them, and that means that he can divine the future in some ways. It's a gift from God, but what is the value of the gift for Joseph? At this point in time, at the beginning of our story, he has a gift, but he really only uses it in a selfish way. He hears something about the future and the response seems to be, "I'm going to tell my siblings that they'll bow down before me." Joseph doesn't think about the application of what he's saying and it damages and angers his family. We're going to see next week that this hurtful application of a good gift will actually lead to homicidal thoughts from his brothers and will actually destroy the family almost. God's gifts used for our purposes will in the end only lead to disappointment. He was looking for his own ends, and it brought his own hopes to fall apart. But the marvelous thing is that there's going to be these very gifts that are also going to lead to his redemption. When Joseph uses what God has given him for God's glory, we'll see God's blessing actually come shining through it. Yeah. And so it's caused me to question, what are the gifts, big or small, that God has given me? And how am I using my gifts? Am I looking to build up my own little kingdom or serve my own purposes like Joseph? Let me tell you how God has gifted me and let me tell you how you are going to bow down to me because of it. Or am I using the gifts and talents that I've been given to honour God and to seek his purpose in my life? Well, I thought for a little bit of a change I might finish with giving us all a moment to think about these two questions for ourselves. Have you had a variation of the same experience of dysfunction in the family in your life? And could God be speaking to you through this dysfunction? Is there an area where God needs to soften your heart and work on you? And what are your gifts and how might they might be used more effectively for the kingdom? Now we're just going to spend a moment now in quiet as we think about that before we continue with our service.